I think there is something in the U.S. people that really wants to be part of a global village, really wants to feel connected to the rest of the world. Individual people can make huge policy differences when they're in the right place at the right time.
Global exchange and citizen-to-citizen diplomacy on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. For over 6 years, a nonprofit group called Global Exchange has helped build bridges between grassroots movements in the U.S. and the so-called Third World. One way they do this is by taking Americans to some of the world's less visited locales. Medea Benjamin, co-director of Global Exchange, calls these trips reality tours.
We go to about 12 different countries, including South Africa, Senegal and West Africa. We've taken groups to India, to Brazil, Central America. Cuba is the place we go the most. We take about 18 trips a year to Cuba alone. We take groups to Central America, to Mexico, to Vietnam and Cambodia. So that's one of our programs, the reality tours. And then separate from that, we have a fair trade program where we buy crafts from 22 countries and we sell them in our stores. Right now we have two. We're opening a third in about a month. And we hope, you know, one day to have stores all over the country that would be not only stores for selling third world crafts at a price that's good for the producers, but also would be centers for education on global issues.
Sounds interesting. So we've got reality tours, we have the craft items, and then what are the other elements?
Well, then we have our public education department, and there we put out our own books and other educational materials, and those will be on issues affecting the United States foreign policy most of the time. So we do a lot of work around U.S. policy towards South Africa, or U.S. policy towards Cuba or Vietnam. We publish books about how people can get involved and go volunteer in these countries. So we have a book called Alternatives to the Peace Corps that give people 120 different organizations that send volunteers overseas. We have another book called Bridging the Global Gap that gives people ideas of how they can get involved in human rights work or environmental work. So that's our public education department. And part of that, what we also do is we bring community activists from all over the world to come to the United States and do speaking tours, mostly on college campuses, church groups, community centers, and talk about issues that are sort of the burning issues of the day.
Now, I want to ask more about the reality tours, because I think people are really interested in this. Now, these aren't vacations, would you call them?
Well, they're vacations in that it's a break from your usual work, and also, I mean, you've been on one of them. We usually have a great deal of fun while we learn at the same time, so in that sense, it's a vacation.
And you work people to death, I think, and in and out of meetings all day long, and you're in and out of the bus. And
Yeah, but I think it shows that learning can really be enjoyable, and I know from my own self, you know, I love to travel, and even when I was young, my goal was to visit every country in the world. I just wanted to get out there and see everything. And then I realized after going to like 40 different countries that, you know, it gets kind of boring after a while if you're not doing something and you're not really learning something. You know, how many beaches can you lie on and remember the names of them? So I think even from just a personal point of view, I wanted to go to countries but to really soak in not just the rays, but soak in some of, you know, what's happening in that country and how can you learn the most in the shortest amount of time and still have fun in the process. And I think that's kind of one of the basic philosophies of our trips.
Now, the people who go on these trips, how would you describe them?
Well, it's a pretty varied group. I would say that a lot of them would be educators, would be teachers, either at the at any kind of level, high school level, university professors. Many of them are in the health professions. We get a lot of students that go on our trips. lawyers. We had all kinds of people. Some of them have traveled a lot to many different places in the same kind of way that I had, that they had been on their own. Many of them are used to traveling by themselves, and growing in a group is a new experience for them. And they figured, well, you know, let me try it one time and see what it's like. And then they get hooked on it, because we have a lot of people that go with us to Cuba and then decide, oh, that was so great, I'm going to go to Vietnam with Global Exchange, or I'm going to go to South Africa, because they find they can do a lot more, learn a lot more with a group than they could on their own.
Now, some of these places that you go are obviously places with great policy differences with the U.S., strained relations, especially Cuba and Vietnam. Why do you choose those particular places?
Well, I wouldn't say that Vietnam has that strained a relationship with the U.S. anymore, and a lot of the countries we go to don't have strained relations with the U.S., I mean, India or Senegal. We pick places because we think there are certain interesting political and economic issues that are going on in them that U.S. people should know more about. In the case of Cuba, we thought we'd be doing one or two trips a year to Cuba, and we found that there was so much interest, partly because it's you can't go there on your own. You really have to go through a group like ours because of the U.S. regulations, that we find we can't keep up with the interest there is in seeing Cuba. Now, you know, if the U.S. would lift the restrictions on travel, anybody could go and they wouldn't need Global Exchange. But in most of the places we go to, people can go on their own, but they feel they can get more out of it going through us.
Some people might say that these people that you're taking aren't policymakers, these aren't people who run in those circles. What possible impact could they have when they get back home?
Well, we didn't talk about what they do when they're there, so maybe I should should say that some of the things they do is meet with leaders of different countries, and you know sometimes it'll be on a high level, although that's not really our interest. Our real interest is to meet with ordinary people in different walks of life. So if we go to Vietnam, we'll go out to the countryside and meet with farmers, or we'll go and meet with health workers, and we'll meet with women's organizations. We meet a lot with community groups. So the idea is really citizen diplomacy. It's really ordinary people meeting with ordinary people and learning about what their lives are like and learning from each other. And it's quite amazing. We have people who come back from our trips who are so transformed in their own way of thinking that they decide to transform their own way of living here in the United States. So it's not like we think somebody's going to go to Cuba and on their own they're going to change U.S. policy towards Cuba. But they might move it in a certain direction when you add all these people together, or they might just transform their own way of thinking about lifestyle issues.
Okay. Well, since we're talking about Cuba, the Freedom to Travel campaign received an awful lot of publicity early this year. Tell us what happened and what the goals were and how it all turned out.
Well, we were talking about Global Exchange and our reality tours, and we've taken groups to so many different countries and never run across U.S. restrictions. We take groups to China, we've taken groups to Vietnam and Cambodia, and suddenly when we started doing trips to Cuba, we realized there were all these regulations to stop us from going there. And we kind of scratched our heads after a while and said, well, wait, this doesn't make any sense. You know, even at the height of the Cold War, you could go to the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. You never had those kind of prohibitions in many other communist countries. You know, why Cuba? And the other thing that we realized when we started taking groups under the restrictions that existed, and that was that the people had to be professional researchers or they had to be news gatherers or journalists. We realized when we started taking groups in those categories that we saw hundreds of thousands of Canadians and Mexicans and Italians and Germans and all these other people who were there just to lie on the beach or do whatever they wanted to do. And they had no restrictions to go to Cuba. So we started to see that the policy didn't really make any sense. We said, if we can go to Vietnam, if we can go to China, if we can go to any other communist country, why can't we go to Cuba? And how come all these other people from all the rest of the world can go there? So we joined with some other organizations around the country and created the Freedom to Travel campaign to challenge the U.S. government's policies on restricting U.S. travel to Cuba. And that mushroomed into just a huge controversy pitting us against the U.S. government.
And the government eventually clamped down, I mean, tried to tried to stop the trip, in effect.
Well, we did one trip in October with 175 people, and the government took away some people's passports when we came back into the country. There was a lot of talk about possible prosecution, and your listeners should know that the possible prosecution is absolutely crazy. I mean, you could go to jail for 10 years and be fined $250,000 for merely going to our neighboring island. So the government, you know, there were people in the government that were pushing for prosecution, and there were others who were saying, you know, this will make us look terrible in the eyes of the not only the U.S. public, in the eyes of the rest of the world, to throw people in jail for visiting a country. So in the end, they didn't prosecute us, and they returned people's passports. Well, they didn't change the law either, so that wasn't good enough. So we planned another trip, and that trip just went at the end of June. Now, a week before that trip was scheduled, we had 200 people from all over the country signed up. A week before the trip was to leave, they froze our bank account, and they, as the U.S. Treasury Department, to stop us from going.
And yeah. As I recall, you had, what, $43,000? In the Wells Fargo Bank.
Right. It's right down the block from us here, uh-huh. And they froze the account. And
what happened? How did you find out? I mean, did you go down there and try to get some money, and they said sorry, or what happened?
Well, that's about what happened. We went down there, and we tried to cash a check, and they said, no, that the U.S. government has frozen your account, and you can only put money in. You can't take money out. We said, oh, that's nice of them. We were in total shock, because we had never got a letter from the government warning us that we shouldn't do the trip. There's what's called a cease and desist order that other groups have gotten when they've tried to take groups to Cuba. We never got that kind of a cease and desist letter. Nothing. You know, that was the first inkling we had that the government planned to do anything to stop the trip. And really, I think it backfired on the government, because, as you said, we got tremendous press from the fact that, you know, here is this nice educational group of people that want to go to Cuba to learn about Cuba, just like they want to go to any other country to learn about that country, and the U.S. government freezes their bank account. It doesn't look good. You know, it doesn't look like a democratic system. So we got a lot of press, and I would say 100% in our favor, because we're not saying we're doing this to support socialism, to support Fidel Castro. You know, it's nothing like that. We're just saying we feel we have the right as U.S. citizens to go places and learn for ourselves. So it backfired in the sense that we got a lot more support. We got Congress people writing letters. We did a press conference in Washington. We even had Congress people coming to the press conference to say U.S. president shouldn't restrict travel. And we managed to get the U.S. Congress to pass a non-binding resolution saying presidents shouldn't restrict travel to any country for educational purposes. So we feel the momentum is on our side, but right now our accounts are still frozen, and we're pushing ahead. We have another trip planned for October as the third Freedom to Travel trip.
Now, you say the account's still frozen, but you went on the trip. How were you able to do that if the money wasn't there?
Well, that was another amazing thing that happened. All the press that we got, when people heard about it, they called us from all over the country. They only knew that we were in San Francisco, and they had heard maybe the word Global Exchange, and they found us in the phone book, and they called from literally all over the country and said, I think this is terrible. Government shouldn't stop people from learning, and I want to help you out. And there were donations mostly of like $25, $50. Some people sent in quite sizable donations, and they couldn't send it in a check, too. We had to do it in other kinds of ways because we had no account. So it is amazing the kind of grassroots support we got, and that we managed in 1 week to either have donated to us or on loan to us the $43,000 that we needed to complete the trip.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with Medea Benjamin, co-director of the San Francisco-based Global Exchange. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Medea Benjamin has been describing the Freedom to Travel campaign's latest Cuba trip. When the group returned from Cuba last year, many of them were detained and some had their passports seized. I asked Benjamin if this year's group got the same treatment.
No, it was a very different reception we got this time. Most of us came through Houston, and when we came back into the country on the first time, there were special security agents all over the place. You could see them. It was like we were going to some big drug dealers had just come into the country. You know, this time it was very quiet, and in fact, when we came through, we heard them say, oh, here, these are people from Cuba. Be nice to them. So they were very nice to most of us. They hassled a couple of people pretty arbitrarily. In fact, my own daughter, who was 13 years old and was on the trip, she had a pretty traumatic experience. She had a T-shirt that said Cuba on it that ironically had been made in China, but the customs agent thought that that should be seized and wanted her to take off her shirt. And you know, it's pretty traumatic for 13-year-old girls to be told to take off their shirt. And she started crying, and it made a whole scene, and that picture got into a bunch of papers, and they finally let her go. They asked her to mail the shirt to her. But for the most part, I would say that we felt like our treatment was pretty good, and that it was an indication to us that the tide is turning and that the U.S. government is going to change its position on this.
Well, it seems like almost every major newspaper in the country has written an editorial calling for some degree of change in U.S. policy toward Cuba. Some newspapers calling for a total lifting of the embargo. Some saying maybe we should lift the press ban. Some saying maybe the travel ban. Do you see any potential for change?
Well, I think it's got to change. It's just a question of how quickly. Our issue, the one on travel, is the easiest one for the president to change because all he's got to do is give his okay to change the regulations. It doesn't have to go through Congress. It doesn't have to be any law. And it's also a constitutional issue about our right to travel, so he doesn't have to come off as being, quote, soft on Cuba. Now, I think the whole embargo's got to be lifted, and it's an absolutely horrendous policy that's been so counterproductive, so irrational, so destructive, that I think the entire embargo's got to be lifted. But I don't think Clinton has the oomph, let's say, to do it right now. Perhaps if he's elected to a second term, or ironically, if we get a Republican president, it'll probably be easier for a Republican to do. So the embargo's got to be lifted in the next couple of years, but I think this travel restrictions could be lifted much sooner.
When you're in Cuba, what do the Cubans say about the travel restriction and about the embargo?
Well, it depends who you talk to, but it's interesting that even Cubans who don't support their government and would like to see Fidel Castro out of power, most of them thank us for what we're doing and say that they think that open dialogue and communication is a positive thing. So you get people on both sides of the political spectrum in Cuba calling for more U.S. visitors to come and more U.S. business to come. You know, it is such a logical position to say that if you want to see the fall of socialism, if you want to see an end to Fidel Castro, flood them with U.S. tourists and flood them with U.S. businesses. So alliances can be made among people who think that there are very good things in Cuba's socialist system that they want to see saved, like the good healthcare system, the good education system, and let's try not to strangle them, and let's not use food and medicines as a weapon like we're doing now. I mean, that we can't even sell food or medicines to Cuba, I think, is pretty criminal. So there's alliances that can be made with different types of people, people from the humanitarian community, the social justice community, with people from the business community to lift the embargo.
This interview with Medea Benjamin was conducted just before the recent changes in U.S. policy toward Cuba. Despite the changes, a spokesman for Global Exchange told me they will do all they can to continue the Freedom to Travel campaign and their reality tours to Cuba.
I want to move into another area, because you were in Chiapas earlier this year. Tell us why you were there and what you found.
Well, I was in Chiapas on January 6th. I went with the first human rights delegation to reach Chiapas after the Zapatista EZLN uprising on January 1st. I went because I was watching television one night and saw some very horrendous scenes on the TV of these indigenous people with fake guns, with wooden guns, bleeding in the middle of the street and being left for several days to bleed to death because the Mexican government wouldn't let any Red Cross people or anybody in there to take the wounded. And it just, you know, tugged at my heartstrings, and I couldn't watch it not do something. And I called Mexico, and I said, I really want to get down there. I want to be part of a human rights delegation. We got to get into these areas. So we went in when the fighting was still going on. It was a very difficult situation confronting the Mexican military to push them to open up to the Red Cross, to open up to the human rights community, which we managed to do within 2 weeks of the fighting starting. So, and I was also just very, I've been going to Mexico for years. I've been looking into the plight of indigenous people for years. I'm a nutritionist by training and worked in Mexico as the first place I worked 20 years ago with poor indigenous people who didn't have enough land or didn't have enough money to feed their kids. And I think I've been saddened by that for 20 years, and then to see that kind of uprising, I felt like I just had to be there watching what was happening and doing what I could do.
Hmm. And what did you report back?
Well, I was amazed at the brutality of the Mexican military during the first 2 weeks of the fighting. I was also amazed at the about-face that the Mexican government did in calling a unilateral ceasefire, calling for a truce. And to me, what it shows is the power of the media, the power of the human rights community, the power that we as ordinary citizens can have when we decide to take action on something. So it strengthened the whole ideas that I've always had in creating Global Exchange, that individual people can make huge policy differences when they're in the right place at the right time.
What do you identify as the root causes of the Zapatista uprising?
Well, I think the root causes are obvious to anybody who goes to Mexico and gets out of the fancy hotel areas and goes to see what Mexico is like. I was just read a report that looked at the number of billionaires that have been created in Mexico in the last 6 years, and it's absolutely disgusting. It's terrible because you say billionaires in a country where people can't eat. There's not enough food for people. There's such inequalities in incomes in Mexico, and that's been exacerbated in the last couple of years. So that Mexico is now today number 4 in numbers of billionaires after the United States, Germany, Japan comes Mexico. And to me, that says that this is a system that is so unequal and that things have to be done to have a better distribution of the wealth that's in Mexico. So underlying the cause of this, of why indigenous people in Chiapas rose up is the fact that there is such unequal distribution of wealth in Mexico.
I read something that you wrote after you came back, and I was struck by a mention in there of something that I really hadn't seen anywhere in the U.S. media about the role of racism in this and the role of feelings of some Mexican towards the indigenous people.
Indigenous people have always been treated in a racist fashion in Mexico and in all of Central America and in most of the world. I mean, certainly right here in our own country, we just about decimated the entire indigenous population in this country. So it's nothing particular to Mexico. But in the case of Chiapas, where the uprising happened, you walk along. Many of your listeners have probably been to San Cristobal de las Casas because it's a prime tourist area in Mexico, and it's a beautiful colonial town. It's just lovely. And what you see when you go out into the outlying areas, very picturesque from a tourist point of view. But when you understand what's marking that reality, that you see these indigenous people who are farming these tiny pieces of land in the middle of a sharp hill, it's because the big, good flatlands have been taken over mostly by non-indigenous, wealthy cattle ranchers that have pushed the indigenous people, who that land originally belonged to, into the worst lands in the hillsides. And that has led to them not having enough land to feed their families. And also that there's not a decent education system for indigenous people. They're not taught in their indigenous language. It's to the point that in some places in walking in the streets of San Cristobal, you would find indigenous people getting off the sidewalk so that the white people could go by. It's 500 years of racism and destruction of indigenous culture, and I think that's about time that it stopped.
I read something about the Zapatista rebels coming out of communities in southern Mexico that had sort of forged collective decision-making civil societies, and Subcomandante Marcos, whom you met, says that they're not interested in state power. Yet those are messages that I certainly didn't see in any of the mainstream press. Explain some of that and why you think it doesn't get reported.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, U.S. press doesn't usually go into a lot of analysis. It's usually pretty superficial. And I think this is a movement that's extraordinary. It is extraordinary. I mean, I don't want to push violence. I don't think violence is the solution. I don't like violence. I don't like the idea of taking up a gun as the way to find a solution to social issues. I can understand why people get to that point, and I can support the issues that they're working towards. So I don't want to glorify the violent aspects of an armed uprising, but I am quite amazed at how pacifist in many ways the Zapatistas are. They really don't believe that that violence is the way to change. They felt that they had no choice but to take an action of that can be called a violent action of taking over six towns in the area to create a splash that would draw world attention to their problems. In the meantime, world attention has been drawn to the problem, and they don't want to go back to armed struggle. They want to find peaceful solutions. And they have been calling on Mexican society all over the country to say, let's look for a peaceful route to change. Let's call on all these sectors of what they call civil society, the environmental community, the women's community, the health community, the teachers. Let's call all of these groups together and put our heads together and talk about how we can have a system that's more democratic and more just in Mexico. So it's quite amazing that you have, you know, what has been reported in the press here as an armed struggle that really sees a very traditional democratic stance as its goal and really believes in nonviolent solutions.
Are you taking reality tours to Chiapas still?
We take reality tours constantly to Chiapas. They're absolutely fascinating. They're not dangerous. It's not like you're going to get shot at. It's an area of a lot of tension, but there isn't that kind of open shooting going on right now. But it's a fascinating place to learn about all of the issues confronting Mexico and in confronting a lot of poor countries around the world. So we go to Chiapas every about 2 or 3 months. We take groups there, and we talk to the cattle ranchers and hear their point of view, and we talk to the campesinos and hear their point of view. We talk to the indigenous groups. We talk to the human rights. We talk to the religious community. And we try to get a real good overview on why the uprising happened and what are the prospects for peace.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the future of Global Exchange?
Well, I think we've hit on something. We're a membership organization, and just in the 6 years, we've had thousands of people that have become members. I think there is something in the U.S. people that really wants to be part of a global village, really wants to feel connected to the rest of the world, and that these kind of ways of reaching out, of going to places, of learning firsthand, of hearing from community activists that we bring to the United States, makes people feel much more in touch with the rest of the world than they might feel by just reading their daily paper. So we just encourage more and more people to get involved with us.
That is Medea Benjamin, co-director of Global Exchange. I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9435, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9435. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by BJ Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.